Welcome to Water in a Thirsty World, Cost and Risks, our first water panel of the conference. We have three panelists here from a pretty wide range of backgrounds and interests, so we're going to talk about water locally, nationally, regionally, some of the things that you should be paying attention to when you're doing stories on water. So not just water itself, but its connections to energy and agriculture development, flood risk, all these things we've heard about in sessions already. So to my right, we have Monica Freiman. She's with Ceres. Ceres is a program based out of Boston that works with companies on water and climate risk. So Monica?
So good morning, everybody. I just want to sort of set the stage and really hammer home why water is so important, why we have to value water differently. As we all know, water is fundamental to all life, but we often forget how fundamental water, abundant, decent quality fresh water is to our way of life. So, fresh water, no thriving communities, no fresh water, no growing businesses, no business activity, no fresh water, no food production, no fresh water, no economic stability or economic growth. So Ceres very much in our work with the business community, the investor community, really tries to integrate water into business thinking. Even though water is so fundamental to everything we do, we still often forget how important it is, and also we're not planning enough for the future on the increasing supply and demand pressures that are going to be put on freshwater resources. So one, increasing population pressures in Oklahoma. JD can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but population is expected to increase by 20% this decade. In California, Texas, New Mexico, several of these southwestern states where there is already pressure and water resources are really over allocated, there is expected to be also 20 plus percentage population growth. I think Texas is 60% over the next several decades. So how on stretched water supplies are we going to really manage this increasing population pressures? I think second to that is, as many of you know, there's a lot more climate variability. Not only flooding, flash floods, what we're seeing in the Carolinas this week, but also, the term mega drought, you're starting to hear that more and more in the media. And sort of, and ironically, drought from a business perspective has really been happening in economically very important regions. So the southwestern United States, California, southern Brazil, Taiwan, where a lot of the water-intensive semiconductor chip production takes place, has all been undergoing drought recently, very concerning droughts. And then if we layer on top of that the fact that we don't give enough thinking and management to groundwater. So groundwater resources, in my perspective, I see groundwater as sort of our savings account. It's somewhere we can turn to when we really need to. Whereas rain is sort of like the checking account. So we're, we can spend the rain away, or we tend to spend the rain away. And then when the rain stops, we really start to turn to groundwater and to our savings account. But unfortunately, we are over depleting those savings and not giving enough thought to our long-term implications. Because unlike surface water, groundwater can take centuries to recharge, if recharge at all. So despite these growing sort of supply-demand pressures, we too often do not put enough value on water. So I'm not necessarily talking about price, but more how we value water society as a business, because it gives us that ability to grow and thrive. What Ceres is doing in particular is we're really trying to bring the business community into the equation, because I think the problem is so big, we kind of can't, not one particular, set of policymakers or regulators or others can sort of do this alone. It really is going to take a big comprehensive push from all sectors, and we really do highlight agriculture and energy in our work. know, agriculture being by far the biggest user of water globally. I think it's estimated around 70%, a little less in the U.S. Energy, water use for energy in the U.S. is probably the biggest user of water, or second biggest. I'm not going to argue with the USGS on this one, but energy use for power generation, oil and gas extraction, we need those partners at the table as well. And, often, especially on the agriculture front, we need to start thinking more of our embedded footprint of everything we do, that a lot of agriculture water risks and water risks in general are through the foods we eat and the fact that we're sort of feeding our way up the water intensity scale, demanding more meat, more protein, which is far more water intensive as well.
Right. Thanks, Monica. We can get into some of the reports you've done with Ceres, the details on how we know what risks to look for when we move into the question and answer session. Next, we have J.D. Strong. He's the executive director of the Oklahoma Water Resources Board. They are in charge of water permitting, water quality monitoring, dam safety, flood risk for state of Oklahoma. J.D. is going to talk a bit about the Water for 2060 Act, which Oklahoma passed in 2012, which set a goal of using no more water in 2060 than in 2012. J.D.?
Sure. Thank you. And welcome to Oklahoma. If you haven't heard enough good slow southern drawl, I'll be here to fill in for the rest of the hour for you. Yes, interestingly enough, so I'm in the position of sort of being the state engineer for the state of Oklahoma, where we issue water right permits. We also do infrastructure financing through the state revolving funds, SRFs, as well as some of our own state leveraged financing. And then certainly last but not least, at the Oklahoma Water Resources Board, we set water quality standards for the state and then do monitoring. And then we have about seven other state environmental agencies in Oklahoma that do the water quality regulations. So Department of Ag regulates ag impacts, Corporation Commission oil and gas impacts, so on and so forth. So water quality regulations where we're kind of divided, and that's pretty similar to how a lot of states kind of organize things, although everybody's a little different. So one of our big responsibilities at the Water Resources Board is to do comprehensive water planning, long-term water planning for the state. And we're supposed to do that every 10 years. In reality, we do it whenever the legislature gives us money to do it. And if you look back at the past couple of water plans and updates that we have done, it always happens in the middle of a drought. So that's when people start getting really serious about planning long-term for our water resources and making sure that we have enough there during the worst of times. And this most recent update was no different. We kicked it off in 2006, which was one of the driest years on record in the state of Oklahoma. And then we finished it in 2012, which was right in the middle of one of the worst droughts we've seen, multi-year droughts that we have seen since the mid-50s in the state of Oklahoma. And so it never fails. And in fact, our agency was created in 1957, which was on the heels of the worst drought of record in the state of Oklahoma. So similarly, Texas Water Development Board was created in 1957, so because it was also their worst drought. So amazing how that happens, right? But one of the things that we did in this comprehensive water planning process, in addition to developing all kinds of data and information in partnership with USGS, Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, and a lot of other state agencies and local agency partners, looking at supplies, demands, projected demands for the next 50 years. And so we have tons of really useful data and information and models that we set up to do this that can be made available now and are being made available now to water users across the state. But we also engaged our citizenry in these multiple years of town hall meetings going around the state to ask our Oklahomans, how do you want your water managed for the next 50 years, and what are the issues that are most important to you? And so we got a lot of really hardcore policy discussion that came out of that. And I happened to come on board as director in 2010, which was sort of the wrapping up, the last 2 years of wrap up and bringing this thing home, so to speak. And so it was really interesting. So we had huge debates on in-stream flows, environmental flows, which, by the way, Oklahoma is one of the few states that really doesn't have environmental flow regulatory regime in our statutes. So it's just kind of happened. You know, we're waiting for the bad example to come, and it has come in a couple of examples already, but especially during the drought. Additional financing, that sort of thing. But the big, really one of my babies out of the priority recommendations of the water plan was our Water for 2060 initiative. And so we actually got our legislature to pass the Water for 2060 Act in 2012. And as was mentioned, it set this statewide goal, underscore goal, that we will consume no more fresh water, underscore fresh, in the year 2060 than we did in the year 2010, actually, which was our baseline year for modeling information in our water plan. But yet we will work to meet this increased growth in population, this one-third growth in water use, through such things as conservation efficiency, reuse, recycling, brackish water desalination, all of those sorts of things. So that really sort of splashed that out on the screen for the first time for our state, and we can talk about that more later.
Yeah, thanks, JD. We'll definitely get into the details of that and how a goal differs from other sorts of regulatory requirements. Our third panelist in the notebook or the brochure for the conference was Brian Richter. He couldn't be here this week because of a family emergency, but we have a very capable fill-in. We have Robert Mason. He's the chief of surface water at the USGS, or the U.S. Geological Survey. So Robert, how does the research side fit into this?
Cool. Well, thank you very much for having me here today. And JD, that was really interesting discussion about what's going on in Oklahoma. And it really ties to a lot of things that we do in the USGS. I think most people recognize the USGS as associated with earthquakes or rocks, geology, that sort of thing, perhaps the mapping. But it turns out that about half the USGS is actually into water, and particularly stream flow and water quality and groundwater, as Monica was mentioning. We're very much active also in monitoring, or at least compiling, the water use around the country. How are we using our waters? What industries are using them more? And energy, as you say, is a very strong or very big component of that. Probably is the largest of the users of our fresh water, along with agriculture coming in as a close second. As it turns out, keeping up with that requires a lot of working with the states. We have cooperative relationships with about 1,800 federal, state, or local agencies, particularly at the state level for things like stream gauging. Some 850 or so federal, rather state and local agencies work with us to fund and collect the data for stream gauges. All of that is essential for keeping up with what's going on in the way of water. We also do a lot of work on research that is oriented to the uses of water, to the availability of water. How much is there and when is it there? Those things are really kind of critical to planning out an initiative like the 2060 water availability in Oklahoma. We do work under a couple of programs that are probably of interest to you all. And we're trying to stand up a new one. Our previously, we were talking about water use and a thing called Water Smart. We've actually done some rebudgeting or reconfiguration of our budgets to focus on water availability and use as a really major topic. In fact, it's one of the four line items that funds all of the water work that we do in the USGS. Water use and availability. And within water use and availability, we're doing a lot of things to develop tools for people like Brian, or excuse me, like JD, who are trying to make decisions about the use of their water, the allocations of that water as it goes through the process. We look particularly at things like groundwater as a major source, as a new source in some ways. We also talk a lot about what can we do to control evaporation, transpiration from agricultural fields or golf courses and that kind of activity. All of this is important for a couple of reasons. One of them is that there really is no other authoritative source for this kind of information on a national landscape, a national perspective. Although it is often a compilation of state and local data collection efforts, it's nonetheless important to keep it all together in a place so that other decision makers, primarily Congress, has that information. Folks at EPA, folks at the Corps of Engineers can also make access to it. So those are some of the things that we're doing, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about them.
So this is a panel about risk, and risk is a combination of the severity of an event and its likelihood. So those two parts don't often get parsed out when people talk about risk. So when you're thinking about risk in water, how do you determine what is a risk? What is the basis for, say, state water planning when you think about risk going into that, or when you're looking at water use for agriculture or energy production? How do you determine what to call risky?
So from our perspective, in water planning, the risk is that a community, a water user, is going to run out of water at some point in the future. So we analyze not only what our demands for water are now, but what they are for the next 50 years. That's sort of the best planning horizon that we have. And then compare that to the supplies that are available that they're either utilizing now or maybe not taking full advantage of later, to sort of do that simple addition subtraction, if you will, which is actually more complicated than it sounds when you're trying to model future scenarios. But and then identify those areas. And what we did in our comprehensive water planning process, in fact, is we looked at our historical record of precipitation and that sort of thing, and sort of used that for the basis of looking at future demands. And if we had that worst drought of record again, where would we see shortages and highlight those areas? And we actually learned that over half of the 82 watershed planning basins that we divided the state up into, which are basically just, I think it was on the HUC 11 scale, which he'll understand is our hydrologic unit codes, but basically surface water watersheds, over half of them were going to experience some form of shortage in the next 50 years in the state. So that's alarming. That's risk. And then we highlighted the 12 that we projected to experience the worst shortage, and called those our hotspot basins. And so we have maps everywhere plastered about, you know, this is our target. This is where we expect to see the biggest risk over the next 50 years, and where we need to target all of our efforts and resources first to addressing those problems. And then, of course, spread around to the others. But it also helps us get folks to understand that they have to be part of the solution, and they need to start thinking about it now instead of waiting for the worst drought of record. And we did, as an aside, really quickly also look at a couple of different climate change scenarios and analyzing that risk as well, because we have great researchers down here at the University of Oklahoma in particular that understand that stuff as good as anybody. Partnered with them to look at that risk too, and whether or not that might even exacerbate the problem.
Right. Just to follow up there, so those 12 basins that you highlighted as hotspots, what are the drivers of risk there? Is it population growth? Is it projected decline in rainfall? Is it groundwater depletion? What is the particular driver?
And so it was a combination of things, and we sort of flagged that. Interestingly, or not surprisingly, they were all in western Oklahoma, the driest part of our state, but it is also the part of our state where we tend to see losing population, not gaining population. So it wasn't so much population-driven as it was sort of increased demands for that water through agriculture, through electrical generation demands, and what could be shrinking water supplies. In fact, we saw in the midst of doing these projected demands and these projections of hotspots, you know, we're hammered by this 4.5, almost 5 years of drought that's every bit as bad as it was in the mid-50s. And sure enough, most of those areas experienced real struggling, almost, you know, water shortages. So it really sort of underscored the fact that risk is not just modeled, but reality at that time. And so for some, it's increased groundwater depletion. So we have a few hot spots up in the panhandle of Oklahoma that's highly dependent on the Ogallala Aquifer. And in that case, it's continued declines in water levels in the Ogallala Aquifer that drives that risk. And in southwest Oklahoma, it's declining surface water resources for the most part that are leading to that risk.
Robert?
Well, I was just going to add a little bit to what JD was saying, that just again to sort of reinforce the point that there, you have a hazard's in drought, for instance, and then you have the things that you want to do, or the values that you have that you need the water for. So that's the risk. If you have an interruption to your water supply, you use or lose rather agricultural productivity. Those two things come together, and they sort of imply different kinds of things to different people. And by that I mean that we, USGS, NOAA, others can help a lot more with the hazard component, defining what the drought frequency might be, what the magnitude might be. But then there's this other piece, this economic in nature generally, And USDA and other agencies come into that, as do the states, as do the local governments. What I think is really important and relevant here is that when we talk about things like a thirsty world, we often express that in terms of human need. Sometimes you need the numbers in terms of dollars, and that's what this conversation about risk helps bring to the forefront.
Yeah, Monica, so you work with businesses on, you know, explaining and communicating water and climate risk. How do you translate what you see on the research side to something that businesses can understand and potentially act on?
So businesses slice risk slightly differently. Everything from they're not paying attention to water at all, and we're really trying to make them aware, to those businesses that are quite water aware and sophisticated and becoming more complex in their water risk analysis. And they tend to use these three elements when they look at water risk. One, physical water risk. So is the water going to be there if I open a bottling plant or move in and to extract minerals somewhere? Two, reputational risk. They're very worried about reputational risk. I often call it like the social license to operate risk. So if a company is going into Peru into a basin and the community is very concerned about the impacts from that mining on water quality and throws them out, you know, to them that's a real water risk. And I would say that is very much the social license risks related to water are certainly growing and needing more attention. A third is around regulatory risks. And I think there's the stereotype that business doesn't want regulation. But when we talk to a lot of sort of the leading companies that we work with, they actually see a lack of regulation as a risk and are trying to support better policy evolution. So, for example, you know, in California where they've, you know, put in finally groundwater, stricter groundwater rules, you know, some companies actually were really all for that because they see a risk as water is not being well managed in the region that I'm heavily invested. We actually want to see better water stewardship and management. So we are seeing some good movement on that front and support from companies.
Okay, going to the regulatory angle, in your introduction, JD, you said the 20 for 60 is a goal underscore. Can you explain a bit more about the goal and how that Water for 2060 Act is playing out in permitting or other on-the-ground effects?
Yeah, so I underscore that because I was programmed to underscore that as I was trying to get it through our legislature. Because, you know, for those that aren't from here, you may not have heard, Oklahoma is a really big private property rights state and pretty much mostly anti-government regulation and oversight. And so you see that in our congressional delegation in D.C. with Senator Inhofe and lots of others, and they are very popular and get there because our folks elect them. So it was important to get that legislation passed that we emphasize the fact that this is a goal that we're going to shoot for, and it's an ambitious goal. And so underscore freshwater, because if we had lots of folks when we first sort of floated this idea out there, maybe even the first couple of drafts of the legislation, say, well, if you're just going to cap all water use, then we're not interested. We can never grow and blah, blah, blah. But we had plenty, we found plenty of allies getting this legislation done if we talked about brackish water desalination. We've got some communities out in western Oklahoma that are interested in that. So that brings them into the fold, and they become interested in this legislation if we can help them get legislative attention focused on shifting from using fresh water to meet all of our needs to tapping into this brackish water resource. And we had many communities, including Norman being a huge one, interested in doing more wastewater reuse and indirect potable reuse and that sort of thing, but they are having trouble getting their citizens interested in it and getting their legislators and others. So if we add that to the mix and talk about all the alternatives that we have to just building another reservoir or building a giant pipeline to go tap another reservoir across the state, then we start bringing additional allies into the fold. So that's why it was important to emphasize that. And then so progress so far, this legislation passed 3 years ago, so and it's a 2060 goal, so we're still very much in our infancy, but we have actually seen some pretty significant traction already with it has begun to really sort of move mountains, particularly in terms of state agencies. We were able to get our other regulatory sister agencies involved in trying to make sure we look at our regulations and overhaul those regulations where we have impediments to being able to meet this goal, where, for example, we had a lot of obstacles to being able to do wastewater reclamation and reuse, and so we immediately set to work getting that done. And it was especially helpful that this was a priority for our legislature and governor that happened. And so we're seeing that. And then what was really, I think, most impressive to me was once this came out and we knew of a few communities that were interested in doing some of these more innovative things, innovative for Oklahoma at least, there was this latent interest all over the place in this. So people started coming out of the woodwork from Guymon in the far panhandle of Oklahoma to Clinton, another small town out in western Oklahoma, started beating down our doors saying, well, now that we know we can do wastewater reuse or brackish water desalination, we want to talk about how we can do that here too. So really started those conversations where people thought that wasn't even an option before.
A lot of risk is a matter of perception. So we talk about flying and driving in two different ways, even though flying and driving have two different chances of death. So are there in the water world instances of the perception of risk not equaling the actual risk as you see it in the numbers? So are places that people are overestimating water risks or places that people are underestimating risk?
I'm trying to think. When we talk about water supply, I think most communities are very much into not underestimating their risk. They really face a huge challenge, especially when there are growing communities involved. They see that water supply as essential for their economy. So I think on that sense, I can't speak to it very well. On the flood side, of course, we could talk about something else, and there are situations where people are probably neglecting the risk that's imposed on them by water.
So I would just add to that, while he's right, I think a lot of city managers and water utility directors and so forth are some of the best at trying to make sure that they adequately analyze that risk. The hard part is getting your citizens to buy into it, and if you can't get them to buy into it, then you don't have any resources to deal with it. And so, you know, it gets back to that. Every time we got funding to do a water plan, we were right in the middle of the drought. It's that hydrological cycle again, you know, where everybody gets really concerned about the drought and then starts worrying about water issues and starts really starting to believe the city manager that maybe we need to invest some money in some long-term infrastructure to weather this drought, and then it starts raining again. We had the wettest May on record in the state of Oklahoma, and it's amazing how quickly interest evaporates in doing something about those water issues. And so that's the problem, I think. Again, it's the people on the front lines. It's the USGS, it's the Water Resources Board, it's the city managers that do a pretty good job of trying to assess that risk. And a lot of times it's the farmers, too, that are the same way. But it's getting the folks that you need to get money out of to invest in dealing with that risk that are often underestimating, except for those brief moments in time, relatively speaking, where you're in the middle of a drought.
So I would just add, you know, there's nothing like taking advantage of a good drought or to, you know, highlight the risk, absolutely. But, you know, it is a two-sided coin. And I think in our work, it can get so depressing, right? And so I think if you really mobilize, okay, yes, there's risk out there, but it actually can be a great catalyst for opportunity or really putting sort of the feet to the fire on the opportunity and solution side. So just as an example, in California with the drought, there's been a lot more interest from the companies that have big agricultural supply chains to do things differently. And so some companies are doing some neat stuff now, like Driscoll Berries in California now is working more proactively with their farmers. So they are not waiting for, you know, everyone else to sort of play catch up. They've gone ahead and are recognizing and mapping those key basins and areas that where they really need the water resources and really need to work closely with the farmers. So they're not detached from their farmers. They're investing, and they've put out a network of soil moisture monitoring so that all the farmers that they work with in the region and even those that don't can have access to soil moisture levels. They set up community water kind of dialogue platforms so that if there are worries about what Driscoll's doing or generally about agriculture in an area, that there's this community engagement process in place. And other investments, they're really actually putting money into trying to be part of the solution. So we'd like to sort of see more of that in terms of managing risks.
All right, we've got a lot of people in the crowd, so I'm going to open up for questions. First, some instructions on questions. So when SEJ members, working journalists, get the first opportunity, those are people with the blue name tag. After those questions are taken, then we can move on to others if there is time. When you ask a question, identify yourself, please, so your name and your affiliation. And no speeches. Everyone always says no speeches. I will cut you off if you start into a harangue or a soliloquy or some sort of verbal essay. So please keep it short if you have any preface remarks. So just raise your hand. I'll bring the mic around and we can get started.
Thanks for a great panel. My name's Ashley Ahern. I work for NPR in Seattle. And I'm really curious about the tension between growth and growth pressures and in-stream flow rules and restricting water rights for property owners, people who already own property and then are being told, sorry, you can't do anything on your property. So I wanted to hear, if there's a central resource where I can find out in-stream flow rules by state, because you mentioned it here in Oklahoma, and I realize I don't know really much about what's going on outside of Washington. And then my second question is, I'm hearing in Washington about mitigation and opportunities for landowners who want to develop despite maybe not having enough in-stream flow or, you know, being restricted by the in-stream flow rule to kind of offset, almost like a carbon offset, their water usage. So I'm curious as to your thoughts about how mitigation might work in that picture of constrained water.
So I have to repeat the question. So questions on growth, development, ecosystem protection, and in-stream flow requirements.
Well, I'll take a stab from my perspective. And so Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
State.
Okay. So I was going to say things are vastly different in the western states, which is Oklahoma, Great Plains, west, basically. You go east of Oklahoma, you've got, you know, the sort of riparian law and way of dealing with water. So in the prior appropriation states, the western states, the way a lot of them deal with it is the same way you deal with everybody that has water rights. You get in line, and if you're first in line, then your water right is protected and more superior than the folks towards the back of the line. That's the first in time, first in right, prior appropriation way. And most states in the West have developed some way of dealing with in-stream flows, and depending on what year they sort of began to deal with it, then they started issuing water right permits to their state fish and game agency or a nature conservancy or however they want to deal with it, but they're just sort of managed within that system. And so if water gets constrained and things get really tight, then they could see that in-stream flow right curtailed. And then also within that system, you allow folks that do come in late can go buy water rights from somebody really early in the line too, if they can raise up enough. If it's important enough for them to save this salmon run and they want to jump up in the head of the line, they can do that. It's just going to be based on sort of a market-driven system. So that's how it works. That's, you know, it's, I've heard plenty of complaints about it, both in my state and in every other western state. The prior appropriation system is archaic and arcane, and it's time to replace it. It's amazing, though, that it's actually a pretty efficient way of dealing with water in the West, and the people that are complaining about it are the people that just don't want to have to pay for the people that were early in line to get the water, and that's typically how it works. And so, you know, here in Oklahoma, I mentioned we're one of the few states that don't really have on the books a way of dealing with in-stream flows per se, and we're actually working on that right now too as a result of our comprehensive water plan. And so a lot of debate about, are we just going to do it like a lot of western states where you come in now, which we could because we're one of those rare Western states that's not fully appropriated in most of our stream basins. So there's still time to get in line and take care of a lot of environmental, fish and wildlife, ecological needs. But by the same token, during that drought, we saw, for example, Canton Lake up in northwest Oklahoma, where City of Oklahoma City took its water allocation out of the lake, took it down to about 20% to 30% full, and it wrecked for a couple of years the tourism and recreation around that lake and a part of the state, especially right around that lake, where that's kind of the only other income they have besides a little oil and gas and some agriculture. So there are a lot of folks talking about maybe we ought to look at it in a different way. As far as resources go, I know I'm a part of the Western States Water Council, which I just blasted back from Manhattan, Kansas last night. And we have done, I believe, a survey of our states to sort of develop a compendium of how the Western states have dealt with in-stream flows, at least a summary. So that resource I know is out there, and I can try to go locate it and get it to you if we just connect before I leave here. Eastern states, I think, are a little bit different. They're just, I'm not sure if there's a resource. There's not really a similar organization of Eastern states, and again, a lot of them sort of are kind of like us. They deal with it haphazardly because in the East, it's always just been wet, and nobody had to worry so much about starving fish and recreation out until now, where they're really starting to struggle with it. You know, Florida, Alabama, all those states now fighting over it. So, do you have anything to add?
I'll try. This is not specifically my field. I'm not into water rights, but it is my understanding that, and you can help me with this, JD, that many states do have in their water rights codes something that simply says the waters will be managed to the best interest of the state overall. There is this first in line, first in right, but there's also some sort of, at least I think in California, some presumption that there's water set aside for other purposes. And I think when you involve things like the Endangered Species Act, that there are opportunities, I'll call that, or label it that way, for people to influence the allocation of water, particularly when a lot of it is owned or managed by a federal or state organization. I do want to go to JD's point about the East. It is relatively new in many places where water and water conflicts, water rights conflicts are coming up, but actually there's a fairly robust history of that in the East as well. Dating back to the 50s easily, we've had a lot of disputes, a lot of legal actions that partition the availability, or rather the flow of water, in a number of rivers. The one that comes to mind, and one that I am most experienced with, is the Delaware River. So that involves four states and the city of New York, and who's going to get what water when. And this comes up in another context, and that's when you pit different industries against one another. In the case of the Delaware, we're talking about water supply for New York City versus downstream issues for trout fisheries, recreational sorts of activities as well, canoeing, boating, as well as even further downstream near the estuary of the Delaware, problems with salt intrusion. When New York takes too much water, what happens to those downstream communities? They wind up drinking or facing more salinity in their waters.
My name is Judith Joy. I work at a newspaper in Southern Illinois. My question is, when companies do fracking, are they supposed to legally identify the chemicals they're using? And also a second question, do many farmers use drip irrigation, which conserves water better?
So a question about chemical disclosure in fracking operations and drip irrigation for farming. So Monica, you've worked on this.
So at Ceres, we extensively have looked at water risks around hydraulic fracturing and shale energy development, and it's like a continuing, there's a lot of work in this area, obviously a lot of risks. In terms of, you know, there's the Frack Focus, of course, the voluntary website that you've probably heard about, that is out there and trying to collect this chemical disclosure data. However, there is still, you know, trade secret provisions that are seen as too tight by most people in there. So industry is getting sort of this free pass in terms of not disclosing what is being shot down the wells. And that's something not only ourselves, but a lot of investors and shareholders are really pushing to have companies disclose a lot more. I mean, personally, I think the industry shot itself completely in the foot by saying, you know, we're not going to disclose. I think that was a real PR and, you know, a real lack of confidence in the communities they're going into. So it's that area and you know, everything from how much water they're using, we want to see greater disclosure on that because those impacts can be very high at the community and county levels along on the wastewater disposal issues. And as you probably know, in Oklahoma, all the seismicity and earthquakes linked with water disposal is a big externality being put on communities. So it is a case study in sort of how things should be done differently and how a lot of these externalities should really be internalized and captured in these activities. So,
excellent. Thanks. Other questions?
What about the drip irrigation?
Oh, sorry, drip irrigation.
I think. Well, I can speak for Oklahoma at least, and you may have the water use data nationwide. I know you do, actually, USGS does, but so we do have both in Oklahoma. I mean, we've got everything from, and I don't know if anybody took the Wichita Mountains tour, you might or might not have gotten to see some of the old furrow-style cotton irrigation down in that part of the state as well, but even in that irrigation district, the Lugard-Altus Irrigation District, we have seen about a third of those farmers switch to drip irrigation, and it's happening more so in other parts of our state. That is our biggest water user, like the world and the nation and most other states. Interestingly, we're a little bit, it's a little bit less of a proportionally a big water user here. It's about 43% of the overall water use goes crop irrigation, and municipal and industrial is just under that. So it's not so hugely out of skew, but part of our Water for 2060 initiative in Oklahoma is to try to identify what we can do to help farmers with more widespread adoption of that practice, and it's going to take incentives and that sort of thing to help make it happen. But what we've seen as we go around and talk to our producers, it's not that they don't want to put drip irrigation in, because everybody that does it has great production returns. They're able to more efficiently deliver their nutrients, their pesticides, and all those things, and increase production as a result of it. So it's a great investment for them. It's just such a huge investment up front that they can't, when they're operating in the margins most of the time, they can't afford to put it in. So I think it's our great struggle to figure out how we can help them overcome that huge upfront cost, especially if the payback is 5 to 10 years. Maybe we can do some zero interest loans, some really low interest loans, help them put that equipment in, and then as that gets paid, as the paybacks come, then I think we'll see more adoption of that. But the demand for the resources to put that in way outstrips the ability. There's a little bit of money available through USDA and RCS to help put in some of those practices and that sort of thing, but it's going to take a much bigger investment to make that happen.
So I'll pitch in a little bit on that. Before I do that, I just want a shameless promotion here. This is a fact sheet from the USGS, and it talks about our water availability program. And down at the bottom, on this side of the fact sheet, there's a breakout of the water uses. So you can sort of see percentages of different uses around the country. And Hannah Hamilton has some coffee. She's holding those up. Thank you. I wanted to speak a little bit to another program that exists that's within the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Reclamation, USGS. It's called Water Smart. The Bureau of Reclamation has been working very closely with USDA, with a lot of state and local agencies, with the farmers, actually, who are involved in irrigation, to try and develop incentives for doing more conservation. And drip irrigation is one of those things. I don't know where the status of the effort. I do know it's well underway. I think it's an important thing for us to continue to do.
We've got two Water Smart grants in our state going right now to work on that.
Cool. Yeah, and that's the Water Smart program through the Bureau of Reclamation, if you want more information. We will have there's a table in the back with handouts from the panelists, so you can look at that for more information afterwards. I think Maria had a question.
Hi, my name is Maria Gallucci. I'm a reporter with the International Business Times. And I had two questions for Mr. Strong. You had mentioned, we're talking about the in-stream flow regulations, which isn't something I'm necessarily very familiar with, but you had said we're kind of waiting for one bad example to kind of catalyze movement around those regulations. I wondered if you could kind of speak to what an example of that might be. And then second, yesterday I was on the tour that looked at different fracking sites and injection wells, and there was some discussion about this interest in using the produced water, the flowback, to recycle it or do different things with it, but the regulations don't allow it, or there's some sort of restrictions. So I wondered if you could talk about what needs to be done there, what is being discussed there, things like that.
Okay, sure.
We got one question on what a bad example of in-stream flow a catastrophe might be, and then reuse of produced water for fracking.
Yeah, so hopefully I didn't say we're waiting for a bad example. If I did, let me correct myself. I think I might have said while we are working on the issue, we have had some bad examples pop up over the course of this drought, but we're certainly not waiting because I have no hair on my head, and it's because I try to be proactive about some of these really controversial issues, and sometimes I lose hide over it. But so we are working to right now to develop sort of an in-stream flow regime for the state of Oklahoma and taking a look at what that might look like going forward. In the midst of the drought that we had the example of Canton Reservoir up in northwest Oklahoma. I think I mentioned that, you know, it got so dry, City of Oklahoma City had to take its water rights allocation out of that lake, and you take over 30,000 acre-feet of water out of a reservoir, it's going to bring it down quite a bit, and it did. And it really was one of the few lakes that didn't even recover after the wettest May on record. It never recovered to 100% full. So as a result, Rec Day, you know, several years of walleye rodeo, which is their big annual fishing tournament that they have at this reservoir, and it fills the inns and cottages and bait shops and everything else that lots of folks depend on to sort of get them through the rest of the year. So it was pretty devastating, and it got a lot of folks talking about maybe we do need to make sure we're keeping enough water back in our streams and lakes to take care of the non-consumptive uses of water, fishing, recreation, because most of the tourism, not just in our states, but a lot of states, centers around water resources. It's all of our state parks essentially are built on around a lake or a stream of some sort, and so it's extremely important. It's our third biggest industry in the state of Oklahoma, and it's that way in a lot of, it's even more so in a lot of other states. So, so that's that issue. And then recycling, reuse, you know, I am not aware. I suppose there are some regulatory burdens to that. I think we've done a decent job in Oklahoma of at least trying to make sure that there are no regulatory obstacles to reuse, recycling of brackish flowback water and produced water from drilling. I think the biggest challenge that I'm aware of is just the cost of it. So we're sitting here in a state that is, again, I mentioned we're not fully appropriated in a lot of our watersheds across the state, so that means there's fresh water available for people to take, and so it's much cheaper just to drill a well and take groundwater or do a deal with a farmer that's got a farm pond and take some water out of it to frack a well than it is to set up a recycling facility and the costly equipment to basically desalinate that water or at least treat it to the point that they can reuse it again downhole. And so it's economics. That's the biggest obstacle that I'm aware of. And we do have a couple of examples where they have put in, like Devon's 500,000-barrel recycling facility out west of Oklahoma City in the Calumet area. That made sense for them because they have such a high concentration of wells to frack around that they put in this centralized treatment facility, bring produced water back, treat it, and then run it back out to other frack jobs around there. So where you have a high concentration, it does begin to make sense. Or if you're in the Permian Basin or the Eagle Ford in western West Texas, where there are no other freshwater sources available, then the dollars and cents change pretty dramatically, and you have to do something with that produced and flowback water.
I just wanted to add to the water recycling bit as well. When we look at, it seems like such a waste to shoot down, you know, deep into these deep well injection sites, potentially usable water. It's, you know, complete consumption of water. And some economic modeling that we've looked at is if you can get enough scale So not looking operator by operator, but if you can get like a regional plan where oil and gas companies collaborate together. And I think what was interesting on the tour yesterday was the talk of involving also the power generators and agriculture into the mix as well, which I think is a really interesting idea. But if you can get the scale, then it actually, you do save money and it becomes cheaper. If you can actually recycle the produced water and reuse it at least for, you know, uses like fracking. But it takes a rethink of business models and it takes also somehow really incentivizing oil and gas companies to work collaboratively, which they don't tend to be in the, you know, it's not their business model. But I think that we'll be pushed to really have to think that those sort of different approaches and models. So,
just a quick addendum. When she said that, it reminded me we have identified a regulatory obstacle for operators to be able to share a recycling facility. We have heard that back from our folks at Continental and several other operators. So I think there is work afoot. It's not my agency, it's the Corporation Commission, but I think there is work afoot to break down that regulatory barrier right now.
What is that regulatory barrier?
You know, I don't know. It's not. I've heard it, but it's not my regulations or rules, so I'm not sure what it is about the rule that. But it, apparently, you know, I think it may just come from maintaining sort of ownership of the waste, sort of that cradle to grave deal. Although it's not quite cradle to grave, we're not talking about CERCLA or Superfund waste, but it's that sort of concept. You produced it; you're responsible for its ultimate disposal, wherever that may be. And so if Continental puts its water in a recycling pit and Devon wants to pull it out and use it, there's just some complications with being able to sort of share what has been a waste stream to date, and it needs to be treated more like a resource that everybody can share. And so we got to sort of cut through that.
Other questions?
Hi, thank you for this great panel. My name is Cynthia Barnett. I am a water journalist, independent, and I want to thank Brett. Brett does such a good job with Circle of Blue, and when I ask this question, if Brett has an answer, I'd love to hear Brett's too, and I'm not sure there is an answer to this, but we heard this morning how when we are constantly transmitting bad news about something like climate change, people really shut down and they don't want to listen and they don't even want to finish our stories, much less make changes. And so when it comes to water, it's sort of easier to write solutions-oriented stories on surface water because there are many, you know, river restorations and dam removals all over that we can point to. My question is, has there been a successful example of an aquifer restoration or groundwater restoration? Is there anywhere in our country or around the world where we could go to write about a successful, a group of people who have managed to restore or replenish their aquifer?
Bad news. Is there a good news story on groundwater protection and aquifer restoration?
So, a little follow-up. Is that from a contamination restoration perspective, or are you talking about water level decrease?
I was thinking of depletion in areas like, you know, Kansas, Oklahoma, Panhandle, but anywhere in the world, really. Is there, you know, because people want solutions, and they've asked me that question, and I really haven't found any. But I've read a little bit of, you know, especially Brett, I think, tends to do good solutions-oriented reporting, and he's written some about the Kansas cooperation on aquifer sharing. So I just wondered, you know, what are the best practices we could write about, and has there been sort of a best practice aquifer restoration?
Yeah, and so I'll try to think about what I've heard in some of the other states. We do see, as we monitor the aquifers in Oklahoma, depletion in most of them. So, but it sort of depends on what you can call a good news story. I also know that our panhandle irrigators that use, I mean, they're over 90% of the water use in the panhandle of Oklahoma. And in fact, it's the biggest water use area in the state of Oklahoma, the panhandle. they have been able to, over the past 10 to 15 years, I can't remember exactly when they started tracking, they are now using over 60% less water than they were using 15 years ago, and yet they have increased the value of production and crops coming out of there. So that, in my view, is a good news story, and what I'm telling all over the place as and try to encouragement for others to try to do the same thing. And so that's them, even though, you know, nationwide we know the High Plains Aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer is in decline. There are numbers of stories about it. There are producers that are working really hard to turn that around on their own without being required to, and that's a good news story. I think for those that went on the tour to the Arbuckle-Simpson Aquifer, Sulphur, Chickasaw National Recreation Area yesterday, while we were engaged in litigation still on our new limits on water withdrawals from that particular aquifer just to protect those springs and streams, that's a good news story that's going to bring measurable results in the future for sure, because we essentially set the limit at less than recharge. So you cannot withdraw even recharge rate out of that aquifer now as a result of the limits that we just put in place, and hopefully we'll be able to uphold in court, and that'll be an aquifer that rebounds rather quickly and overflows into those springs and streams that you got to see. And I'll give some thought to whether or not, as I just spent a week with other Western states water guys, whether I heard any more. But
so, unlike us fighting over the microphone, I actually find, you know, water does, what keeps me going, I think, is water does connect us, and it tends to really force us, but it's a good thing. I think it does force people to work more closely together. And from a series perspective, one area that's been heartening is where businesses have really competed against each other on water, and in the past, there's a campaign now called Connect the Drops, where businesses are actually working together to support good legislature, to show their support for good water policies. And, you know, that wouldn't have happened without a drought or concerns. And it hasn't necessarily, you know, shown positive results yet on the ground in terms of groundwater recharge. But, you know, there's a hope that if you can bring those key players together, it will have those types of positive results.
So I'll add just a little bit to this. I'm sure that there are efforts going on to restore the water levels of various aquifers, and I'm sure they're having some success. It's not my field, and I really can't rattle them off here. But if you're talking about, when you say restoring, if you're talking about structural change to an aquifer, that's a very, very heavy lift, a very hard thing to do. When you deplete an aquifer, when you remove the water from it, depending on the structure of that aquifer, you can actually cause it to compress. And getting it, that means that you have less space in the future, volume in the future, for future water to occupy. And the aquifer isn't going to recover. It's extremely, you can't pump it back up. You can't reinflate it in a sense. So there are places where that has occurred and where the prospects for restoration, to use your phrase, is very nil.
Edwards Aquifer also comes to mind as another. I'm not sure if they've restored water levels, but San Antonio has taken some really aggressive steps on reuse, recycling, aquifer recharge, artificial aquifer recharge, to try to restore water levels in that really important aquifer.
Yeah, and Cynthia, I would just highlight there's a lot of discussion right now on aquifer recharge across the country. And one example is in Wichita, Kansas, where they draw from the Equispeds Aquifer. So they have an aquifer storage program that they take high flows off of the river and put that underground. And that came into, it was completed either last year or the year before. And I think the results were in from the first year. You'd have to look up the numbers exactly, but it was something like 50% drop in withdrawals from the aquifer because of all the extra water they're putting in. So that's one example. And then on the policy side, Arizona gets cited a lot as a state that acted early in 1980 to put in a groundwater management act that looked at management of groundwater in some key areas in the state. They also store a lot of water underground from the Colorado River to use in times of shortage. So they have about 4 million acre feet in Arizona that stored Colorado River water. So those are a couple that I would point out. Questions?
One of the stories out of Colorado with prior appropriation is that for the last number of years, we've been trying to make it more flexible to reflect changing conditions. And of course, it began, Ashley's point, with in-stream flow back in the early 1970s, expanding to recreation. And now we have quite a lot of conversation about shifting on a short-term basis from agriculture to cities in terms of drought. With the lingering question of, we don't want to go too far too quick because we don't want to unleash unintended consequences. So my question is, in the context of Oklahoma, what is happening now in trying to make prior appropriation more flexible for changing conditions?
This first-in-time Western water law, what might be changed in Oklahoma?
So I guess the short answer is nothing. You know, again, I think it gets back to how allocated your state is. And Colorado is essentially fully allocated pretty much statewide. And so once that happens, you're capped. There's no more water, and it's just a matter of now sharing amongst the people that already have their water rights permits, and you have a very sophisticated court system now set up to deal with that in Colorado that is unique to any other state in the West, but it's essentially still based on prior appropriation. Here, we don't have that in Oklahoma. So, you know, we are starting to talk about recreational needs and non-consumptive needs and how does that fit in with our prior appropriation system that has largely ignored that issue going forward. And I'm not sure if we needed additional flexibility to deal with it or if we just need to make sure it gets woven into our prior appropriation system. Because as I said before, you hear a lot of folks complain about it and the need to loosen things up and that sort of thing. But for the most part, states are reticent to do that because it's just a really sort of refreshingly clean way and orderly way of dealing with water rights. And there's it's the further west you go, there are markets that have developed. You talked about the transfer of ag water rights to municipal water rights, and I think you sort of couched it in a short-term sense. I'm not sure it's going to be short-term for Colorado because I think, if anything, you're going to see it, you know, things become more constrained and you're going to see the water flows towards money. We've heard people, I didn't come up with that, not sure who did, but I've heard it a lot now. And so it's because those, you know, Denver can pay a heck of a lot more for water rights than somebody growing alfalfa around Pueblo, Colorado, that's why it's going to continue to drive that way. So the real looming concern that I have in a big ag producing state like Oklahoma is, if that's the case, are we ultimately going to drive all the water towards the cities, the industries, and leave ourselves high and dry for the food that we're going to have to feed this growing population at some point? I'm sure everything will correct itself, and I'm not saying throw out the prior appropriation system to deal with it, but that's one thing that I think is concerning and will be interesting to see how we grapple with that inevitability as things continue to shift in those drier, more fully appropriated states like Colorado, like Arizona, like California, as things shift from ag to municipal industrial.
All right, we're close to the end here, so I've got one more final wrap-up question. I guess it would be about risk and knowledge. So what do we not know at this point that we need to learn to address risks? So where are our knowledge gaps, and what would you be looking at on the research side or the policy side, things that need to be changed in order to address some of these things?
So from my perspective, what would be really helpful from a knowledge perspective is to how to really message the value of water better. I think we too often get it confused with the price of water, how much you're actually bringing in as part of a supply chain or to a municipality or ag, but I think we're not capturing the value of what that having that water and the ability to use that water, how much value that produces. If we can change and really solidify the messaging around value and you know what all that creation is, I think it'll change the conversation. I think it will motivate us to work harder, and it will bring more perspective in terms of the real need for long-term planning as well.
Amen. So I'm glad you said that because I don't have to waste my time saying that. I totally agree with that. That's one of the biggest struggles. And it is, water is not just a commodity. It is a much more valuable resource than that. So it is really hard as a result to truly assign a value to it from the ecosystem services that it provides and that sort of thing. So definitely that. We do a pretty good job working with hand-in-hand with USGS in particular, kind of quantifying how much surface water and groundwater we have and how that's changing over time. And we can do a pretty good job of projecting demands for that water and that sort of thing. I would say because risk in water world is largely driven by drought, another huge challenge we have is what does the future look like? And not just, you know, you hear a lot of debate about what's the climate going to look like 100 years from now, 200 years from now. Climate change kicks in. I'm talking about we want to know what the forecast is for next spring when we need to plant some crops of a certain sort. And maybe if we knew with some predictability, reliability, what next spring's forecast is for rainfall through the summer, we might make completely different cropping decisions and or livestock decisions and water landscape watering decisions and so on. And so one of the things we've been pushing for, and we've got the National Integrated Drought Information System, NIDIS. I went to testify to Congress to get it reauthorized. Very important, but really we're only halfway good at forecasting drought about 90 days out, and even that is not much better than your 7-day forecast from your weatherman. So that is a huge challenge, I think, when it comes to risk. If we can get better interseasonal annual forecasts of drought and when drought will subside, waxes and wanes, that will be extremely valuable to us from a risk management perspective.
All right, so I agree entirely with both my fellow panelists. The issue of explaining the value of water and then making a forecast for how to use and allocate it is important. As JD was saying, the near term is important. And in some respects, and I'm not a forecaster, I can't really speak to that, nor can the survey generally, it's really the Weather Service and NOAA who are more into the forecasting, though we USGS do work a lot with them on their modeling. But they are making, we are making, dramatic improvements in how we forecast things like floods. Unfortunately, as we were saying earlier, they're sort of near term. We can work with that and we can adjust our reservoir levels and things like that to anticipate them to some degree. And we're doing that better and better and further in the future. Droughts are a little harder. Droughts are harder because they're longer term. They sneak up on us. We don't see them quite so quickly, so well, but we are making progress there. The problem that I see here is in terms of forecasting versus long-term. River levels, stream flows, reservoirs, we can deal with more short-term. The groundwater is a long-term problem, and it's really harder to optimize the system short-term and not cause problems long-term. That really becomes a stretch. And lastly, you know, I'm just reminded of a quote from, I think it was Ben Franklin and poor Richard's Almanac, that when the well goes dry, that's when you know the value of your water. And that's kind of where we are in some respects.
A few remarks from me. One, we don't want to get to the point where the well goes dry before we recognize the value of water. So that is the big challenge, as panelists said, is communicating that and getting the response before the crisis. And that is a huge challenge across the country in every jurisdiction. As the first water panel of the conference, I hope you took away some of the complexity of this issue. It's local, it's regional, it's national. Rules and regulations vary by county sometimes, by state certainly, so it's very difficult to get a grasp on what's going on. And our panelists have showed that water risk is not just water quantity and wells going dry for a town. but it's tied into all of economic production, from food to energy to tourism and environment. So you have a lake that goes dry. That's not just a water source for a town. That is your lakeside resort. That's your restaurant that operates and requires people to come to the lake to earn some money. The waitresses that earn tips from serving people that come to that resort. So it's not just a water issue. It's an economy-wide issue. And that's what we need to be reporting on for journalists in the crowd, is it's not... we at Circle of Blue, we talk about breaking out of individual sectors. And so water is the economy-wide sector. We do have a couple more minutes if there are any lingering questions. Otherwise, we can adjourn and be first in line for lunch.
How about I make a quick announcement?
JD can make an announcement.
That's not condoned by SEJ, but Ben Franklin also said beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. And so from 4 to 7 today in an Oklahoma City-based brewery, I will be there for samples, pint fills, growler fills. If anybody's interested, see me after this. I'll tell you all the details.
Yeah, some Oklahoma alcohol water at the brewery. So thanks, everyone, for coming. Lunch is next door in the ballroom. And if you have any questions for panelists, see them. There's materials in the back if you want handouts.